Well, I think I'd like to start by thanking Lourdes and Vito for inviting me. Certainly, I never thought of myself as mathematically inclined, and so it was a quandary coming to this meeting. Certainly, I enjoyed math, but it was more for the people. And so you can imagine my surprise yesterday when I found that probably, I think, at least at some level, like a mathematician a lot of the time. So it was a pleasant surprise. And so far, this meeting has been outstanding. I've really started to think in new ways. So I'm going to talk about two things. I'm going to talk about the concept of invasion as a general concept as it relates to angiogenesis and as it relates to metastasis at the end. Because really what I spend most of my time doing is metastasis. And so the results I'm going to show you today are going to span a time from years ago to data that I haven't yet published and will be submitting next week. So you'll sort of get a range, a gamut of data. Yesterday we talked a little bit about the microenvironment and extracellular matrix, and we touched on it in general terms. But I wanted to take these textbook photos and start out by showing you that the ECM exists between these cells, and this is actually during embryogenesis, and this is a proteoglycan-rich ECM that exists between the cells, and these are the cells in dark here. And that this extracellular matrix has a number of functions. It acts as a depot for growth factors. It acts as a support for the cells, but the cells can communicate with each other. And so if you actually look at fibroblasts in a scanning EM, what you can see is that the outline of the cells here, and then these strands that you see all over are actually fibrils of ECM that are actually connecting the cells to each other. And you can see that they're pretty taut in this image, and that could actually be an artifact of preparing them for the electron micrography. But if you actually take cells and grow them in a 3D collagen gel, so these are like clusters of fibroblasts in a collagen gel, what you can see are these lines of force that line up between them as these cells begin to contract the gel. So rather than a chemical level of communication between these cells actually know where each other is. Once these lines of force come, now these cells will begin to migrate directly towards each other. So the extracellular matrix does a lot of things. It's not just simply a scaffold for our cells. It's conveying information. So to understand how the ECM works, really, we have to understand how integrins work, because integrins are the principal receptors on eukaryotic cells for extracellular matrix. And integrins are composed of an alpha and a beta subunit. Okay? They pair shortly after being made, and once a pair comes together, it stays together for the life of the molecule. Now, the expression of different alpha and betas, and there's several of these, it's altered during activation and differentiation events. It's really required for responsiveness to other growth factors, so you need to have the integrins bound to some sort of ECM ligand in order for other growth factors to work. And really, I'm talking about receptor tyrosine kinase subfamily of growth factor receptors. And the last thing should be obvious, but it's really worth saying, that the types of matrix that integrins on the surface of the cell bind affect the cell's ability to recognize its environment. So if you have a cell that's principally in a collagen environment that has no collagen receptors, it can't sense that environment. So these molecules, now let's extend this concept beyond the idea that they're just receptors, but they're also biosensors. So they're giving the cell information about its local microenvironment. I put this slide up. I just want to touch on it briefly. We now have a basic crystal structure. We know more or less what integrins look like. There's different families of integrins. You'll see that the numbers don't run in order within each family because integrins get numbered as they get discovered, but evolutionarily, these are the conserved groups. And then these are the most primitive prototype integrins, and these bind a conserved ligand, RGD, as well as other ligands. Even though I call these collagens, some of these have wandered off and they can now bind to other matrix proteins as well. So these are a little bit promiscuous, so you have some crosstalk between these groups and between these groups, etc. But the important thing to note, let's go back, is that on any given cell, you're going to have between 6 and 12 different kinds of integrins on the surface. All right? 6 and 12 different heterodimers. And that allows them to sense different extracellular matrices in different ways. Okay, so the way integrins work is once they bind to an extracellular matrix, they tend to cluster on the surface of the cell. So they work a little bit like Velcro. for them to work most efficiently, you want larger clusters of them. Small clusters will tend to release. Once you get a good cluster forming, then you have a variety of signaling molecules that will come in and anchor at the bottom. And this is an actin. These are actin filaments that are unlabeled in purple here, but you have a number of other signaling elements that come together and bind in different ways. And I really mean this because you can see the same molecules binding apically here and sort of downstream here. So this sort of gemisch actually represents molecules that interact in a variety of different ways. And this signaling and the tension that it puts on this actin cytoskeleton allows for migration, it allows for signals that mediate survival, and of course the growth factor responsiveness that I mentioned. And the most important thing to take away from this is that this tension here is critical. Because if you actually eliminate the immobilized status of a ligand and you just add a very small part of the molecule that's in solution, you no longer get signaling, you no longer get the formation of this complex, you don't get mechanosensation in these cells, and you have an aborting signaling event, and these cells, there's no productive signaling. So when this was realized probably about 15 years ago, actually probably 20 years ago now, by Erkki Ruoslahti, he thought that maybe this offered an therapeutic option where you could begin to block the critical signals coming from this complex that would go into the cells and mediate survival. So to talk about this, I actually want to talk about angiogenesis now. And angiogenesis, especially during tumor formation, is like a wound response where blood vessels grow in, but that wound never heals. So it's always in an immature status, and it can be induced by a number of different growth factors. We heard about VEGF earlier, but also basic fibroblast growth factor. And there's more than 30 other protein factors. There's also some bioactive lipids, and there's even polysaccharides that can promote this process. And what happens during angiogenesis is you have some sort of hypoxic tissue. Now, we're interested in cancer, and it's a tumor, but it really doesn't have to be a tumor. Any hypoxic tissue will do. For example, there's large tissue changes during arthritis, and so you have a similar hypoxic environment where you can actually secrete angiogenic factors. And you begin to change the surface of the nearby endothelial cells. So they will start to express new molecules. So these are adhesion receptors like integrins. They'll start to express proteases by which they start to digest this matrix. And then they'll start to invade towards the hypoxic environment. And the idea is that eventually they want to get there, mature, and then supply oxygen. Of course, in a tumor, they're never going to mature. They will feed that tumor, but more likely they're going to provide a means of egress. And they're going to actually secrete other factors that are going to contribute to tumor growth. So the first evidence that integrins that were upregulated, like alpha V beta 3 in this particular case, probably came from Dave Cherish's group. And what he showed with Marty Friedlander in 1995 in this model is they took these sort of pellets that were loaded with, in this case, either the fibroblast growth factor or VEGF. And what they did is you implant it in the cornea of an eye of a rabbit or a mouse, and you can actually have the blood vessels begin to grow towards this growth factor. But in the presence of an antibody to alpha V beta 3, this was completely blocked. And this is actually what a normal eye is looking like. With a control antibody, alpha V beta 5, it wasn't blocked at all. The interesting thing that they found is, and the surprise, was that when they used VEGF, the alpha V beta 5 seemed to block, and the alpha V beta 3 had a much more marginal effect. And what this suggested was that we knew that integrins were cooperating with growth factors to signal, but maybe different integrins cooperated with different growth factors. So that raised the theory that when something like this, where growth factors would bind, you would get signaling at the surface, and then it would come to the side, but they would converge on a common pathway. And so if you blocked with an anti-alpha V beta 3, you could block this arm, but not this arm. Similarly, if you blocked with an antibody that saw alpha V beta 5, you would block this arm, but not that arm. And then if you use drugs downstream that could block the central signaling pathway, you could block both. And that proved to be true. But these drugs that block proliferation here are pretty pleiotropic, and they're going to block it most effects. And the other thing, so, and there's actually other pathways that are involved with these growth factor receptors here. So the growth factor tucks in here. Without the integrins, it's not going to signal. When the integrins are ligated to an immobilized matrix, you're going to get your signaling. And you can signal not just down the pathway that we just talked about, but there's other arms to the pathway, and these arms talk to each other. While I was at Scripps in Dave's lab, I actually did this work, and this is actually happens to be an arthritic joint. This isn't a cancer model, but it was, I think, the first large animal model that showed that if you took a small molecule antagonist integrins, and these are not antibodies now, these are actually the small RGD cyclic peptides that were injected into the animals, and you looked at the blood vessels and the tissues after being treated with this molecule or a methylated version of it to inactivate it, what we found is that first, we look for blood vessels and we stain the blood vessels in green with factor 8, a von Willebrand type factor antigen. The first thing you can see is there's less green in the antagonist treated side than the other side. And then we look for cells that were dying, and so that's a tunnel stain in red. And what we found was that some of these cells that were coming off the edges of these vascular cells started to stain red and die, similar in all cases. We saw a lot of apoptosis here, or programmed cell death, associated with the vasculature, which might explain why there's less vasculature on the side. In the control side, we knew that our reagents were working. We could see some cells dying in the tissues. You will always see a few cells dying in hypoxic tissues. But not that much was associated with the vasculature, surprisingly. And indeed, there were a lot more vascular cells. And these were actually, really, in neither case did the vasculature look very mature. But this is sort of confusing, because I said that alpha V beta 3 is present on angiogenic blood vessels, and we add an antagonist to it. But I told you earlier on that there's 6 to 10 different integrins on the surface of a cell. And so if you really need integrins for signaling, and you've got a matrix like this in vivo that's very heterotypic, and you've got many growth factors coming in, why should blocking a single growth factor signaling pathway kill that cell? It just doesn't make sense. These cells have other integrins that are completely ligated, and the other integrins will associate with growth factors, and they can be positively signaling in. So that part of it didn't seem to add up. Okay. Another thing that didn't add up is we actually knew for about 15 years that there's a population of Ashkenazi Jews that actually has mutations in beta 3. Their beta 3 doesn't work. Now, it turns out that beta 3 is very important in platelets in your blood, so it's important in clotting. But, you know, these people had blood vessels. So it couldn't be critical for blood vessel formation because of that. We knew that antagonists caused the apoptosis in vivo, right? And we knew that they were actually working in different animal models, and these are actually being tested in different tumor models right now, including glioblastoma. So if these are causing so much apoptosis, but the knockout animals and people that have knockouts have vessels just fine, does that create a paradox? Is that a disagreement between one set of data and the other set of data? And then there's the other paradox that I told you about, which is, what about the case with all the other integrins on the surface of the cells? Why can't they keep the cell alive? So there was a paradigm at the time that integrins weren't really implicated in it. And it went something like, when a receptor was ligated, it could create a survival signal. And when the receptor was unligated, or in the case of integrins antagonized, it could actually promote apoptosis. And this actually seemed to fit very well with the data that we'd been generating at the time. So this, just to look at, to test this more carefully, we wanted to know if just the presence of the integrin on the surface could mediate survival. And we decided to make it a really tough choice for the integrin because we didn't antagonize it, but neither did we provide it a ligand. So we took different cell lines that either expressed this integrin at moderate levels, expressed it, didn't express it at all, or expressed it at high levels. And really, this is the daughter cell line, and this is the granddaughter cell line. So from this cell, we got this cell. And if during the selection we changed it in some way, we would have supplied the integrin. So we should be maintaining any mutations or selections from one population to the next. And that's why we went back and forth. And the number of integrins on the surface of these cells, based on the flow and estimates we had from other more precise assays, was this is probably around 200,000 on the surface of cell, between 150 and 200,000, and probably around 500,000 per cell in this group. Now, if you put these cells in a collagen gel in three dimensions instead of on a dish, and you let these cells crawl through this collagen gel, they're actually quite happy for a while, but then they begin to die. And what you see, to our surprise, was, again, the cells that actually lacked the integrin did the best, at least for the first couple days, and then they began to die. But the cells that expressed the integrin actually died very quickly. In fact, more cells died in 24 hours of the cells expressing a lot of beta-3 than cells that didn't express any. So simply the presence of the integrin on the cell, surface of these cells was killing them. Now, these cells could bind to collagen, they could attach to it, they spread through it. They had about 50,000 receptors. But this actually creates an interesting paradox now, because now you have cells with that can sense some of the matrix that they're binding to, but many of the receptors on the surface are unligated. So this is sort of like a biosensor model, where the integrin feels out with its receptors to find out what environment it's in and tries to decide whether or not it's in an appropriate environment for its programming. And if it's not, then it will actually execute a death pathway. And this is conserved in tumor cells. It turns out these were originally advertised as immortalized endothelial cells. We found out later that there had been a mistake at ATCC and that these were actually bladder carcinoma. So this does work in tumor cells. We went back and we actually did these experiments in endothelial cells, HUVEC primary cells, and you see the same thing, except the death now occurs in the first 24 hours. The whole curve if you change these time points to, for example, 8, 16, 24, you basically get similar data. So I'm going to make a long story short. Why do the cells die when the integrins aren't ligated? We've got cells put down in a collagen matrix here. We've got the integrin stained for you in red. I've got the caspase stained for you in green. A caspase is a pro-apoptotic molecule that induces apoptosis. In this case, it's called caspase 8. And they actually colocalize very nicely at the tips here. And it turns out that this activity of this caspase at the tips is actually critical for the apoptosis that we see. And we did the experiment where we could ligate integrins, and in ligated integrins, actually it was amazing, we could see some caspase activity even in living cells, but these cells didn't die. In contrast, if we left the integrins unligated, the cells began to die and we began to see patching on the surface, and these were either on the surface or just below the surface in small vacuoles, and there was colocalization between the integrin and a stain for active caspase that was killing cells. And then just, I don't want to belabor it, this is just biochemical evidence. Caspases undergo a process whereby they switch from one size to another size when they activate. So this was just a second way to really know for sure that we were seeing the caspase 8 go from an inactive to an active form. And we actually separated out the different parts of the cell so we could see that this was actually happening at the membranes. And we did one last experiment. And this was, so you could argue that maybe during angiogenesis, the invasion of these tumor cells really required a specific type of ECM that it had to interact with. And so when you blocked it, that the cells couldn't invade and would eventually die because they couldn't invade. And so what we did was we actually blocked their ability to invade with an antibody and then prevented them from dying by adding in an inhibitor of the death pathway of the caspase. And so here we go. So we could induce angiogenesis by adding a growth factor, like basic fibroblast growth factor, and we could induce blood vessel branch points per unit area. And if we added an antibody to the integrin alpha V beta 3, we could block it. But then when we added a caspase inhibitor, what we found is now these blood vessels could form again. So this is with the antibody plus the inhibitor together. So what's happening here is that even when this integrin is blocked and can't work, as long as you prevent the cell from dying, the other integrins do the job and it crawls in and you get blood vessels. So this fits because we know that people who don't have this integrin can form blood vessels. So here we have an active sensor that when the cell is in the wrong environment, these cells die. When the cell is in the wrong environment, it doesn't detect the correct ECM, these cells die. Okay. What does this mean for angiogenesis in the larger physiological context? Well, if we look, take this as one example integrand, and remember, there's 24 of them, okay? So it actually is pretty promiscuous. It can bind to a lot of what we call provisional extracellular matrix proteins. These are proteins that are made during wounding or deposited from the blood. And so vitronectin, fibrinogen, denatured collagens, and by denatured, I mean it could be heat denatured, or it could be digested by proteases. It binds to oncofetal proteins that are produced in wounds. It binds to a few basal ECM proteins, but not many, and it binds to cell surface adhesion molecules. But what's even more interesting, I think, is although those generate positive signals, it also binds to a number of soluble proteins and fragments. And these have been given different names, but in general, these are pieces of these proteins that have been digested, with the exception of thrombospondin and a few molecules that are actually created and designed to be soluble antagonists. But these are usually multifunctional and do a number of jobs and have just added on the ability to bind to the integrin. So when these bind, you can actually block the interaction. There's actually a number of pathogenic factors as well, viruses and snake venoms that are soluble that will also take advantage of this, which we don't have to go into. But what this means is if you have a cell that expresses alpha V beta 3, when it's ligated, that cell's happy. It's going to be living more than dying because these integrins are going to cooperate with all the other integrins on the surface to keep this cell invasive and happy. However, if it's not ligated, or more, and we find it even more efficient when it's antagonized, then you begin to get cell death. Now, going to the knockout model or the human gliosin thrombocythemia model, where there's no beta 3. There's really just no interaction to consider in this case. So these cells are going to be happy and you're going to have a high survival to death pathway because you've got no negative feedback possible. So what does this mean in angiogenesis? This means that, in the case where beta-3 is present, the more soluble ligand you have produced, the more protease you have produced, the more small fragments and antagonism, the less angiogenesis you have because the more cell apoptosis you get. The less you have and the more immobilized positive signaling you get, the more blood vessels you have. All right? Now, what happens in the case where there's no alpha V beta 3? Well, it turns out that during development, the number of blood vessels is normal. But as soon as you impose a pathological condition like cancer, the number of blood vessels becomes increased because now these cells lack a negative feedback to kill those endothelial cells. So I still want to talk about the same biosensor function of integrins. I still want to talk about caspase 8. I want to switch it to a different invasion model now, and I want to talk just quickly about metastasis because it's very similar. It's using integrins. The cell has to be able to move to metastasize from one site to another, whether it's local metastasis or whether it's distant metastasis. And more importantly, the cell has to survive because if it moves all the way here and then dies, it's really not a metastasis you have to be concerned about. And with the exception of actually cranial tumors, a lot of the actual problems we have with cancer is the metastasis. It's not the primary tumor, which can often be removed or resected. So, all right, let's skip ahead. So the model that I use is neuroblastoma. And again, this model is going to vary a little bit from ones that we've talked about before because neuroblastoma is a children's disease. So you don't have decades to accumulate mutations in neuroblastoma. It tends to present in children. If the child is younger than 18 months, it's generally a good prognostic indicator. If the child is older than 18 months, it's a negative prognostic indicator. So it's a very aggressive disease. It has 70% mortality. It's actually, I think, the second most fatal behind cranial tumors in children. It's a disseminated disease, so these tumors start in one place and then move all over, and this is actually what eventually leads to mortality. And the interesting thing was that these cells tend to lose caspase 8 or integrins, which is what drew my attention. So the question was this important for disease progression? And this is just in a murine model that we did. It's one of the models we use. We also do egg models that I'll show you. And these are just actually two ovaries. And you can see a normal ovary here, and this is an ovary that's got a metastasis to it. So these tumors go different places, and they can grow very, very large. This tumor, I think, was 3 grams in a 21-gram mouse. And the last thing to see about these tumors is that they'll grow on a dish, and they'll grow flat in the shape that you may be used to, but some of them tend to be able to round up and survive for some time in a rounded form. And so this is an Anchorage independent, so these cells are not dying. So this also fits with the idea that they've lost caspase 8 and they can have unligated integrins and not die. So we took a number of cell lines, and I just want to show you that some of them are missing their caspase 8, some of them have caspase 8. And we can grow these tumors on the surface of a CHICKAM, and they will attract the vasculature even after a few days. This is only 4 days, I think. So this is on the surface of an egg. And then we can actually look at a section here, and we can actually look at the tumor cells invading them. And for these studies, what we did was we first labeled the cells with cell tracker red, which is just a fluorescent dye that allowed them to track track them as they move through this very thin transparent membrane. And we actually used cells that expressed caspase 8 or didn't. And what I want to show you is that if you have cells that express caspase 8, as you look at that edge of the main tumor and you look at local invasion, you see a few cells going in, but these cells don't look happy. In fact, you see parts of cells in many cases where you've just got a few vacuoles. And if you stain them for apoptosis, you see that these cells actually look like they migrated some way and then died. Okay? If you have cells that lack caspase 8, you still have invasion in the local tumor here, but you have fewer dead cells. In fact, I think there's some dead cells here too that should be pointed out. But in general, you see many live cells that can actually invade the matrix, and they look pretty happy because they're sending out processes and they're moving further into the matrix. If we take these cells and we put caspase 8 back into them genetically with using a virus that integrates the gene, a single copy of the gene, what we see is that now these cells begin to die as they migrate into the tissues, and you have fewer cells. So this is local invasion. Does this really matter for what's going to happen to the animal in the greater, broader context? So to do those studies, the one thing I wanted to say is we did look in the main tumor as well before I move on, and in the main tumor there's absolutely no differences. So this suggests that what we've seen already is that when the main tumor grows, it tends to be able to produce factors that will keep its cells alive and keep its cells happy. And this isn't surprising because all of these cell lines that I work with actually have come out of children and were aggressive and successful. Okay, so distant metastasis. Again, this is the big problem in neuroblastoma. A lot of it is distant metastasis. So for this assay, we actually do a very similar thing where we let the tumor grow a little bit longer, and then at the end we'll harvest the animal, we'll take out the lungs or the long bones, we'll isolate bone marrow, and then we'll do a trick where we're actually looking for the human ALU sequence. And an ALU sequence is just a repeated sequence in human DNA, but the trick is that it represents about 4% of our total genome. And that allows us to have a high degree of sensitivity in being able to detect human cells in an avian background. So our level of detection is probably, the good labs can do probably down to about 100 cells. We are probably between 200 and 500 cells that we're detecting. So if you grow the tumors in the CAM for the period I talked about, we're growing them now for 8 or 9 days, and you just look at the size of the tumor when you weigh it in milligrams, just looking at the size of the tumor, you really can't tell if they lack caspase 8 or if they express caspase 8. There's no way to tell just looking at the tumor. And again, by apoptosis, no way to tell. But when you start to look at metastasis, the cells lacking in expressing caspase 8, you see that the cells that have caspase 8 can metastasize. And again, perhaps this isn't a total surprise because these cells were successful at metastasizing in children. These are all from bone marrow of children. But what you do see is that the cells that lack caspase 8 are far more metastatic. So they can survive and they do very well moving. So it looks like losing this gene is important in the short term, at least, for these cells to move from one place to another. Now, I'm not going to go through the other data, but we've done all the genetic manipulations. So we've taken these cells and put caspase 8 back in. They quit moving. We took these cells, which are successful anyway, and if we knock those caspase out, we see at least two of them get better at metastasizing. So it really is playing a role in these cells. We're convinced of that. So you have this model where you have a primary tumor in kids where caspase 8 expression doesn't impact the growth. It doesn't impact anything except the ability to spread. So when these cells migrate through the tissues, they undergo apoptosis if they express the caspase 8, if they're going into the wrong tissue. But if they lose caspase 8, now they have resistance to those sort of biosensor feedback pathways, and now they can survive. And so the question is, therapeutically, you know, maybe we there's ways that we can restore caspase-8 to restore apoptosis, because in most cases, this is an epigenetic regulation. So it's actually a methylation of the gene. In a few cases, it is actually deletion. So Natalia actually came up to my lab after we published this. Was it last year she came, or the year before? And we talked about maybe modeling this. And the problem was that caspase-8 isn't the main oncogene. MYC is the main oncogene in neuroblastoma. But we talked about the ability wherein you'd have tumors that had caspase-8, and then through a gene loss, you'd have cells that had one loss of caspase-8, and then either through chromosomal recombination or subsequent gene loss, you'd have a cell that was deleted and then would be metastatic. And it seems like this would take a very long time, and that's probably why it's the rare case in neuroblastoma. Whereas if you had an epigenetic mechanism, you might be able to do a one step from here to there and very quickly methylate both genes, and now you would have a metastatic gene. And this, because this is what we see, I mean, this one step mechanism probably explains it better. So I want to come back to this idea that we can, you know, maybe in these cells that are methylated, maybe we can use drugs to bring them up and then use this therapeutically to treat these kids. Is this really a good idea? And 2 years ago, I thought it was an outstanding idea. Let's do this. It's easy to do. We should be able to really impact the clinic immediately. We've got drugs that are already in the clinic. 5-azacitidine. It suppresses the DNA methylase. It should be able to increase the caspase-8 expression. It's been shown to do it in vitro. The problem is the drug doses that you need are on the level of toxic. But there's other biologicals you can use. So, for example, there's interferon gamma, and that can also increase caspase-8. It's a methylation-independent mechanism, so somehow the gene is transcribed even though you still see it's methylated. And this is a STAT-dependent mechanism. So we've got a couple drugs that are in the clinic that we can use. So it's possible. But even though I told you that 90% of stage 4 and 75% of stage 3 tumors lose caspase-8, that means that 10 to 25% still have caspase-8. And they're malignant, and they can metastasize. Maybe not as well in the systems we looked at, but they still get to where they're going. So will just turning caspase-8 on be enough? Second, many of the non-neuroendocrine tumors express caspase-8. So if you look at colon carcinoma, if you look at breast cancer, if you look at any of the epithelial cancers, they don't lose caspase-8, and this is mind-boggling because they have decades to lose expression of the gene. So why don't they lose it if it's really so bad for the metastasis? So I think the answer ends up being kind of evident if you realize that everything works in pathways. And so downstream of caspase-8, there's another caspase that actually does the work. Caspase-8 is the trigger, and caspases downstream will do the killing. And so I tend to think of not signaling. I showed you a linear signaling pathway at the beginning, but I don't really believe that signaling occurs in pathways, okay? I believe that cell signaling occurs in webs. So I think of them in terms of spider webs, and I actually think in terms of different cells as simply having different shaped webs, where pulling on one strand will actually impact every other point in the cell depending on its distance in nodes from the original stimulus. And so, I mean, this may represent one type of cell. This may be a different type of cell where you still have the same targets in the center, but you have different molecules pulling on different strands. You may have a cancer cell where things are dysregulated, and now you may have strands that actually dead end, but still have the potential to impinge on different pathways. So if we zoom in on this cell and we imagine for 1 second that maybe this is a node where different caspase signaling, like we saw previously, caspase-9 can activate caspase-3, and I showed that caspase-8 will actually activate caspase-3, and then this will go on to kill cells. Maybe these cells just somehow compromise this downstream event and don't mind having expression of the upstream. But still, statistically, you would expect that some cells should lose this. So we did the direct experiment. I'm an experimentalist. This is what we did. We took the cells that had caspase-8 put back into them, and we knocked out caspase-3. And when we did this, we then went ahead and did the tumor metastasis, and we looked at where the cells went. And so I just want to show you, again, this is just recapitulating the data we had before, that you can't tell difference in tumor size. The cells that express caspase-8 have much less metastasis. Now, you'll see that the scale of the graph has changed. And the reason that the scale on the graph has changed is because when you actually do this experiment, this is what you find. You find that the cells that express caspase-8 but lose caspase-3 can metastasize again. But not only have they restored ability to metastasize, they have an enhanced ability to metastasize. And this is statistical and repeatable. So a gene which we showed and we proved caspase-8 blocked promoted metastasis, now when it's present, it enhances metastasis. How is this possible? And if I didn't have an idea, I wouldn't have shown you. All right. A huge portion of my lab is dedicated now to the study of caspase-8 as a molecule in its own right, and it's stained in green here. And red is actually an active tyrosine kinase, which isn't necessarily important. But what I want to point out is the different places we find caspase-8 working in the cell. And the most important for this is that you see it at the front in the ruffles of migrating cells. All right? You see it other places in the cytoplasm. We see it doing things in the nucleus. And you can't see it very well here, but when we actually adjust the pinhole very thin on the confocal, we can absolutely identify it sticking to microtubules and centrosomes. So it's playing a lot of different roles in the cell. Long story made short, we've done the molecular mapping, we understand how this works now. It increases the migration of cells. So when cells express caspase-8, you get enhanced migration, you get, and this is probably due to the fact that they have enhanced adhesion to substrates, and this is an integrin-mediated process, and this is true on different ECM proteins. So as integrins are biosensors that talk to the caspases downstream feed back to the integrins. And so when we're thinking about modeling these things, we kind of have to draw the arrows in more than one direction. And so I want to end sort of on this sort of a concept whereby I showed you this model where maybe we have this easy model where caspase-8 is lost, and or an epigenetic mechanism where it's silenced, and then you end up with metastatic tumors. But this cell, this might be a good short-term solution, but this cell has now lost the option to keep caspase-8 but inactivate something downstream and now have enhanced metastases. So we now have a choice for this cell at this point. This is probably a lower probability event, we know from the neuroblastoma studies, because we see this is the more common event. But in this case, we can still get metastatic disease, and in some cases it can be more metastatic. All right? Now, the reason we think we don't see it being more metastatic in most neuroblastomas is because most of them really still have an intact caspase-9 to caspase-3 pathway. We think they don't fully suppress it, but somehow they get around it. But most other tumors can get around it because they've had decades to knock out different signaling pathways. And so the model comes something like this, where if you have cell surface molecules like integrins interacting with the extracellular matrix in a mobilized state, when they're unligated or antagonized, they can signal to caspase-8. These two somehow talk to each other because caspase-8, when it's not killing cells, it seems to be helping here. All right, so it's got these two choices. And then there's yet another model where sometimes cells can turn off their integrins so they don't signal. But usually it's a negative signal or a positive signal, and the cells can switch between those depending on whether or not they're immobilized and clustered and signaling. All right, so a lot of unanswered questions, but I'd just like to thank the group that did this. This is my lab at UCSD. Kieran's now moved on, and we've actually had a couple people join. For some reason, I couldn't access my lab site to update this picture, but I thank NCI, NIH for my funding. We've actually got a new imaging grant as well, an ICMIC grant through signaling, so I want to talk to some people here about that as well, and mathematical models of imaging. Thank my collaborators at St. Jude Research for the neuroblastoma. Thank my apoptosis interaction people, Guy Salveson at Burnham Institute, Marcus Peter at the University of Chicago, Ben May Institute, and also Dave Schlepper, I've been working very closely with, who's a focal adhesion kinase migration person, who's now at UCSD. Thank you.